Okay, so before we get started talking about this topic, I want to point out that we're not going into detail about it because of the intimate nature of it, but more everything that's surrounding it that people are and are not looking at. And of course, what I'm referring to is the Stormy Daniels interview on 60 Minutes last night.
So did you watch the interview?
I did.
What were your overall impressions?
You know, and because part of the reason for watching it, because the talk about Stormy Daniels is nothing new, but the fact that 60 Minutes, which you normally would consider a very serious source for putting out content, was doing it, that kind of piqued my interest.
And it had crazy ratings, like super high ratings. So, okay, so why don't you tell me what you thought about the actual interview?
Well, there's a lot going on. I mean, you have her and her claim of the affair. You have the president and the president's denial of the affair. And then you have the attorney, his personal attorney, Cohen, who paid her the $130,000 to sign the NDA to not disclose this affair. And then all of the political ramifications that could or could not come from that, because that was done during the time he was campaigning. And so aside from just, you know, I don't have a personal feeling one way or another towards anyone. I do, if she was in fact threatened with physical violence, like, that's, you know, come on, that's not right. And I feel really bad for her for that. But otherwise,
so she says at one point that she was threatened by physical violence. Was she threatened in a parking lot or something? Is that the...
Yeah, she said she was threatened by a man in a parking lot in Vegas at a gym. Which, you know, my first thought was, and even at the end of the interview, Anderson Cooper was like, you know, there's going to be more. This isn't finished yet. And something that they pointed out
more
was...
More people that threaten her?
No. If she was threatened, it's probably not the first time this person who made the threat has made threats, period.
Oh, I see.
Almost to imply, not that he was, you know, factually stating one thing or the other, but logic would state, like, yeah, okay, if I go to your house and I threaten you, do I or do I not have past behavior of threatening people with something, you know? And so what it implies is that there may or may not be other stories that will come out where someone was threatened violently or in some way to keep their mouths shut or whatever else.
Oh my God. So this could become like even more of a thing.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. The next thought I had was, okay, if she was at the parking lot in a gym, you know, many, many retailers have cameras watching their parking lots. So I wonder if there's like some hidden footage that could possibly come out from this. Not that they knew it was hidden, but, you know, some footage of this, some surveillance of this. To see who this guy is, you know, and then if they found him, like what that turned into. Like, so then there's all of this stuff, right? Then the second component is Cohen made the payment to her, and it was done days before the election. And so did he make an illegal contribution, an in-kind contribution?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. So they're acknowledging that this was a payment made on behalf of the Trump organization, or that Michael Cohen made this payment on behalf of Trump?
No, they're acknowledging that Cohen made this payment on his own accord.
Yeah.
Period.
Oh, and just because, like, he just... But what is the reason they're giving for him actually making the payment? They're just saying he...
Well, he himself actually came out and said the reason he did it was because he cared about the president and his family and that any attorney would do this for their high-profile client.
Okay.
So, the guy that came on the show... Let's have some conversations with our attorneys.
If Joe's listening, I'm looking forward to when he bails me out of a porn star scandal.
So just so you know, here's what we're looking forward to. But yeah, so anyway, so the guy came on the show and he was like, it almost would have been better if Trump did reimburse him, because then Cohen could not be come into question for violating the capital contribution limits. And what Trump could spend, I guess it may or may not have really impacted those limits.
Brutal.
And then because there's this other thing going on with Mueller in Russia and like all of that controversy,
yeah.
you know, they're looking at Cohen because Cohen was doing something for Trump in Moscow, like back in 2015.
Yeah.
And so they're just going to like, basically they're going to be probably building the case, the prosecutor yeah. or may use this piece of information for something else or it's really, it's fascinating to watch
yeah.
and understand to the extent that, you know, what tactics are used just with attorneys in general, right? Like any high profile case, you get to see this, like, you know,
yeah.
what people are doing and why, but this, of course, is the president of the United States. And so yeah. it's...
Michael Cohen seems like he would do just that. And he seems like a great attorney in the sense of he'll walk in front of any bullet that is coming their way. Like, historically, that guy is kind of like a Doberman. He just goes after stuff.
Yeah, he seems incredibly loyal,
he
right?
He totally is. He'll just get on TV.
Trump lucked out there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, so in some ways he gets the best people, I suppose.
Yeah, so anyways,
okay, so
we'll see what happens next.
So anyway, did it leave you thinking that she was telling the truth, at least about the affair? Like that had happened?
You know, it's interesting because she had signed documents stating that she did not. And when on TV, she said, you know, the only reason I signed those is because I felt threatened or intimidated or, you know, these were the reasons why. But no, this did in fact happen. And I mean, if they're offering the woman $130,000, why would you do that if it wasn't true? I mean, this is complete speculation. But if they didn't see that that there was some concern or some threat that she could pose, they would have been better off letting it be, oh, some porn star is trying to capitalize. But because they offer her that money and that document, it makes it seem like it lends to the credibility of the entire thing.
Yeah, it seems pretty likely
that
it occurred.
Yeah. And then if she was in fact threatened, I could see why she would lie and say, oh no, I didn't, you know, this isn't
yeah.
true. Like, you know, she's worried about herself and her family. And
do you think that this is, do you think anything about this is deserving of all the attention it's getting right now?
You know, I was talking with my girlfriends last night about this. I was at dinner, like when the interview happened, and then I watched it after the fact. And, they were just remarking how, like, you know, it's unfortunate that something that happened so long ago, and this was before all the details
yeah.
came out, right, in the interview, and we saw what happened, but they were remarking how something that happened so long prior to the president being in office, short of, like, imposing on free speech rights, it kind of sucks that you could be so blatantly embarrassed for something you did, right? If that
yeah.
was it, like, say that was it. Like, say he didn't threaten her, say he didn't do all this other stuff, and he literally just had an affair with
yeah.
her. Like, dang, like, you're the, you know, like, imagine, like, if you are in a place of public eye and doing well, not doing well, whatever, and then someone's like, oh, you slept with so-and-so 20 years ago. You know, it's like, how's that legal?
Yeah.
And so they were like, oh, you know, it's not right. Like, and they're not Trump supporters per se, but just the fact that our president, the president of the United States, the person who represents you and me
yeah.
and all of us, you know, combined as a whole, could be so utterly embarrassed.
Right.
But what was missing was this payoff, an illegal in-kind contribution, number one. And number two, did he threaten her?
Right.
So if those two things are true, then, you know, this definitely deserves the attention that it's getting.
Those pieces do, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And the reason that they're so, the reason that they're interested in calling this a campaign contribution is because Cohen's statement about how, you know, he was protecting his client, essentially, is a confirmation of him violating the campaign finance law because it was an effort to influence the election by buying her silence.
Correct. So what happens? Does he get in trouble? I mean, if he violated campaign finance law...
You know, it depends. There's, and this is why this is so complicated, because there's so many lawsuits happening and there's so many things being, like, thrown back and forth. Yeah. You know, you have Mueller investigating the stuff with Russia, who is, you know, what Cohen has done is definitely coming into question now, and what happens with that is up in the air at this point. Although they do say that a lot of times these things just end up in monetary damages, but, you know, we'll see. And then you have Cohen, who's now, like, I don't want to say countersuing because that's not the word they used, but is suing Stormy Daniels for $20 million or up to $20 million for violation of specified breaches in the document. Yeah. And then you have Stormy. I don't know if they're suing the state or they're doing something, though, to make it where basically the lawsuit is about making that document that she signed, that NDA, null and void. They want to call it null and void because apparently Trump never signed it. The president never signed it.
Right. I did see that.
And so if he never signed it, they're saying it was never, the agreement never went into effect. And so there's just a lot going on.
I don't know
with all of this. It's messy.
It sounds very messy. And it sounds like there are a lot of, like, really messy pieces of what's going on there. I would be under a lot of stress, I think, if I were at the White House right now.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine. So stay tuned to see what happens next. What comes on the news next with this, but.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything, are there any, like, cliffhangers here? Or is, like, what's the next thing that's going to happen?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, this story was, just coming out was a big enough thing.
The next enormous scandal just kind of wipes this one out of the news cycle?
Yeah, I hope
we
not.
We just wait till next week when some other crazy thing happens?
For sure, in the public's eye, yeah. But in the background, these lawsuits are real and they're happening.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's going to have to be a progression. So.
Well, at least Stormy Daniels' career seems to be revitalized. Is she going to start making porn again, or is she going to be an author or something now?
I don't know. I don't know what she's going to do. But she was talking about, not during the show, but there was, like, an after the show, like, candid moments that they showed. And she said that people were asking her to do a parody where she reenacts the scene, but like with someone who looks like the president, but like as a parody, and that she turned it down. But I could see, like, an SNL moment happening.
Totally.
Because nothing's off limits with SNL. Well, I guess short of, like, I don't know, what you are or not allowed to do when it comes to, like, nudity and things like that. But I'm sure they could make it work.
Yeah, this thing, I mean, I feel like I'm in agreement with you insofar as, like, this, like, if this were just an affair or something, that's really nobody's business and it shouldn't be a big deal. But if there was, if the way that it was handled in the background were, like, threats and bribes or whatever, that's a little bit scandalous and probably unbecoming of people that you would want also running the country, at least. I mean, like, that's where it gets to be, like, culturally, is it, do the, you know, when you talk about somebody representing you and me and our values and everything, it's like, I think the cultural or philosophical question is, do you want somebody who's, I mean, it's kind of like an adulterer, right? Like, he was married to Melania Trump and just had a kid somewhat recently when this happened. And is that in line with American values? And maybe there's some controversy around that. So much of this, they wanted to really scandalize, I feel like. When I was hearing stuff about this, ahead of at least the interview. Like, there was the thing about how she spanked him with a rolled up magazine with his face on it. And yeah. people ahead of, like, when I didn't, outside of the context of her being like, oh, somebody should spank you with this magazine. And then he was like, oh, yeah. And then kind of like went with it. Like, that's what really happened. It sounds like, where ahead of this interview or ahead of her putting more context into it, it sounded like people wanted to sensationalize it and make it sound like it was some weird fetish that Trump has and kind of like introduced into the evening. But it wasn't really that. And the other thing that people seem to be making a big deal about is just the whole thing where it's like, this happened while he was married or whatever. And I don't really put too much.
Like, what do you mean? Like, it's like it shouldn't be in the public eye kind of thing?
Yeah,
or you
it's nobody's.
Think that it was wrong.
It's nobody's business. You know, I mean, it's like, whether it's wrong or not, it's really, who knows what the whole story is there. And
it's a private matter.
It's a private matter. And nobody knows what the what the story is. And so it should be out of the public concern and public eye.
Yeah, and even Anderson Cooper actually addressed that after the show. They talked about the fact that they did leave out a lot of details that they thought were making it more about the affair.
Yeah.
And they didn't want the story to be about that because they felt like there was so much more than that. And really more focusing on, okay, put the private stuff, it should be private, but it's a part of the story, so we have to air it. But really, this is about... you know, the campaign contribution and some of these other things, the threats and the what Stormy Daniels' lawyer calls thuggish tactics.
Right. I don't know. That sounds like a nightmare to have to deal with.
It sounds like a nightmare.
You know, I don't know how anybody can live that way. I mean, whether it's true or not. So there's a series out on Netflix called Dirty Money, I think. And each, I think it's 6 episodes, and each one profiles different people who kind of made a lot of money through scandalous ways, allegedly. And one of the episodes features, it's all about Donald Trump and the sort of Donald Trump organization. And one of the things that they say in this coverage is that he has never not been engaged in a lawsuit. Like, the entire time there's been, like, a Trump organization, basically, that he's been engaged in lawsuits decades and decades.
The entire time he's, like, been in business.
Exactly. And I just can't imagine what it must be like to live under that. Unless...
Well, you probably become an expert at it.
he would have to. He would hope so, right? Because none of these have ever... Has he ever...
Yeah.
No, he's never been, like, taken down in court, right? Like, he's never lost, at least as far as I can tell. He seems to come out on top. There isn't, like, there was that one time Trump really got his. He became the president of the United States. You know? This is too funny. Well...
Yeah, imagine, like, being involved in lawsuits for the last 30 years.
Yeah, multiple ones, like, simultaneously. It just seems like that would be such a life-draining, awful way to go through life. Unless you've got people like Michael Cohen or whatever. He's probably got a whole team of people who are burdening the stress of all of this for him. So I guess that's how you deal with it.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
For sure.
You're not the one who's actually dealing with any of this.
But what do they say? I mean, you only need to do something for 10 years before you become an expert.
Yeah, I think it's like 10,000 hours or something like that. 10 years, 10,000 hours.
So he's like an Uber expert.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just Googled it, and it looks like before his presidency, he had over 3,500 lawsuits.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
That's, like, so bad. That's so funny.
Yeah, but check this out. Yeah. It shows 1,900, he was the plaintiff. And then 1,450, he was the defendant. And then 150 was like bankruptcy, third party. Other.
Oh, man.
So in half of them, he started it.
But that could have just been like a preemptive thing or whatever, you know. But that might play in line with him getting better at just dealing with the legal system and how that all works.
He can't have won all of those. There's got to be some statistic we'll find somewhere.
Oh, sure. But there was never like...
We'll edit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you can't win all of them, but I bet you he might have like a 90% success rate or something. But
oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, he never settles.
Yeah.
So that's...
And then...
Someone who's willing to go to task, you know?
Well...
Such a drain on your energy.
Such a drain. Anyway. Cool. So when will Stormy Daniels be coming onto the program to talk with us about her side of everything? Have we worked that out yet or what?
I'm sure she'll be getting a lot of requests for interviews after this.
Well, do you think more people are buzzing about the Stormy Daniels thing or for the gun reform, gun control rights laws reform marches that occurred on Saturday?
Oh, wow. I mean, as of Saturday, everything was about the marches, because I was on Twitter just like randomly glancing through trends, and like out of the top 20, yeah, 15 of those were related to the marches in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, wow. I don't know the total numbers. I feel like a number that's sticking in my mind, I think, is 2 million. And I don't know if that's like 2 million people total in the United States. Oh, wow. Kind of went out and marched, but if 2 million people went out and marched, you could probably reasonably assume that more than 10 million people were aware of people out there marching and raising awareness around people's desire for stricter gun control laws. I saw on Snapchat, so Snapchat's app has a maps feature where you can kind of zoom out and they highlight interesting stories and by geography. So if you zoom out far enough, you can kind of see like what's going on right now in the country that's of interest. And the whole map was pretty much dominated by coverage of marches in all the different cities in the U.S. And it was really interesting kind of catching like a like, I feel like Snapchat's one of the few platforms that can do this, if not the only platform that can really do this today. Where you can kind of like zoom around a map and see what's happening in that area. So that was kind of a really interesting look into what was going on, but it seemed like a massive turnout.
You know, the fact that all this is happening in an era where everything is on the internet and technology is so abundant, what impact do you think the use of technology is going to have on something like this?
It just amplifies the message in a crazy way. I mean, those kids, that girl, Emma is her name.
Emma Gonzalez.
Yeah. You know, she went from, you know, obscurity, nobody knew who she was, to she's got like over a million followers on Twitter, at least. I don't know her other platform stats, but like overnight, they were able to get their message out to, I mean, when was the shooting? How long ago was that? Like 2 months, 3 months? That was 6 weeks ago. That wasn't even, is that right? So, I mean, in the span of like 5 or 6 weeks, and I think largely on the back of social media and the savviness that these kids have and their ability to get on there in a presentable and in a good way, in an effective way, like overnight they were able to connect to the entire country, the entire world. I mean, there were marches happening across the globe on Saturday. There were 2 million, I think, in the United States people marching, but there were protests happening across the whole globe. And I think this is largely the difference in this one, because usually what happens is you get a little bit of thoughts and prayers, and then it kind of just goes away a week or two later, right? Whenever there's a shooting or some horrific event. And so this one is not only sticking, but they're getting people seriously mobilized. And they're making it, I mean, they seem to really be turning the heat up on politicians and turning it toward, like, putting politicians who aren't playing ball on blast, basically. So the effect really is just that you can rapidly get the message out to a lot of people really quickly. And the other takeaway might be like, get really good at social media.
Yeah.
You know?
So acceleration.
Acceleration, definitely. But it's you have to be able to do it well, I think. You know, it's not that anybody anywhere can just like cause a movement or a thing to happen. You still have to have an effective message at an opportune time. And there are a bunch of other factors. And
well, the massive awareness it's created too, yeah. right? Because how many companies like dropped
their relationship with the NRA?
Their relationship with the NRA as a result of
like
the yeah. events following the shooting.
Like all of them. You know, there was that list was going around on Twitter. People, I mean, it was crazy. It was like people were like passing around a bingo card where it was just like they just kept dropping and saying, oh, here's the 2 out of 12 companies still supporting the NRA or whatever. I mean, the heat has stayed wow. on and doesn't seem to be going away. The question that I have in all of this is like, what's the next, like, what is, I think, I mean, what, like, what was the goal? Like, what was the like deliverable, if you will, on the turnout on Saturday? Like, is the idea to just really point out that a lot of people care about this? And then so there's a lot more pressure on politicians to begin to engage with new gun legislation or to threaten their seats? I mean, when, like, when are midterm elections?
Yeah, I, you know, there's been so much popping up about it, but certainly, certainly one of their goals is to put enough pressure to force some kind of change. And they're, I mean, they're relentless.
Yeah.
Like, these kids are relentless.
They're relentless, and I think a lot of people are
in their quest.
They are, and they're getting a lot of support from adults. Because yeah. adults, it's funny, it's like the sentiment.
Adults and companies, too.
Of course. I mean, companies, you can kind of, companies are, that's just capitalism for you. Like, I think that, mm-hmm. I think that in the sort of company space, they know, like they've seen the tide kind of turn here. And that's why all those companies dropped their relationship with the NRA and now are.
You think it's just about business?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, I think that the pressure is certainly there. Like the pressure on you as a business is definitely going to be there.
Yeah.
And so I think more of them, I'll put it this way. I think most of those businesses that dropped their relationship with the NRA didn't do it because they suddenly had some kind of moral epiphany. I think they did it because their customers were like, we're going to boycott you or, you know, they got enough pressure from their customer base to like think that their bottom line was going to be affected. And that was the ultimate determining factor. Something just becomes toxic.
Imagine how long it would have taken them to get the kind of attention they're getting now if all they had was newspapers.
I don't think you would get the chain reaction, you know, like so much of this is about building this kind of viral chain reaction and momentum as a result of that. And that quick feedback cycle. I mean, I can't believe it's only been 6 weeks. I mean, I honestly thought that this has been going on for 3 months. Right? I think I said that because it feels like it has been because they're keeping the message going, you know, and they already have yeah. the audience. Like I said, each of these kids is probably in the 7-figure plus range where it comes to social media presence, and everybody loves them. Like, is there any? I mean, there are a few people kind of getting like whenever I see somebody, like what's his name?
Yeah, anytime someone's gotten some flack, there's been like 100 people that will then have their back.
Well, yeah, it's like there's a once in a while you'll see a tweet go out. Some politician did this yesterday, the day before. He was the guy who they got that like hilarious Google result for. I can't think of his name, but regardless, he said something kind of like knocking the kids, and he got like immolated in the press and social media spheres because he's kind of like attacking these kids. Like they're national heroes at this point. So I feel yeah. like they're going to stay visible and they're going to stay connected just because they've built these massive audiences. People are, I think the American public is tired of hearing about school shootings and all of this stuff happening. So like you've got the activation energy you need from the general populace. You've got the young people who everybody wants to put their faith and hope into that they're going to be the ones who can affect the change because adults seem to be helpless to do anything. Or we all seem to be locked into a, like the adults of the world seem to be locked into a kind of stalemate situation where business, politics, and the NRA sort of meet. And so I think this will be a thing that continues until something changes. I don't think this one's going away. I don't think those kids are going away. I don't think that people's support for their agenda is going away. And I don't think that the NRA is going to come out with some amazing, like, idea that's going to compromise and make everybody feel good, you know? Their best ideas were like, well, let's just give the teachers guns. Like, we need to just, like, arm the teachers and train them to kill children. And then that's how we'll solve the problem. Did you see that article about...
I think that was the president's idea.
Well, where do you think he gets it, though? Like, I mean, there's a room, you know, there's a room of, like, embattled, like, spin agents that have worked for, like, the gun industry that have just been sitting there trying to message around these crises for years. And I can't imagine. They're probably, like, just so defeated at this point. Did you see that article about a Pennsylvania school giving buckets of rocks to... Here's the headline. Pennsylvania school to arm kids with buckets of rocks as defense against school shooters.
Are you kidding
Officials in Schuylkill County are planning to teach students to throw rocks at school shooters. The superintendent of Blue Mountain School District testified to a state committee in Harrisburg last week that each classroom in the school has been equipped with a 5-gallon bucket of river stone, according to the WNEP-TV. If an armed intruder attempts to gain entrance into any of our classrooms, they will face a classroom full of students armed with rocks, and they will be stoned, Superintendent David Helsel said to the House Education Committee in Harrisburg. I mean, how crazy is that? Like,
that is not fake news, right?
Not The Onion. I mean, literally, this is from John Gruber's Daring Firewall blog, and his headline linking to this is not The Onion. Pennsylvania school to arm kids with buckets of rocks.
That's the silliest thing I've heard.
It's really, I mean, it's getting to the point where it is almost like an SNL skit, you know? So anyway, something's going to change. I think that the dam has broken on gun control laws in this country.
Is there anything else you want to talk about related to the technology in this movement?
Sure. I mean, we, you know, one of the things that we were pondering was, you know, back to this idea, like, of like what are we accomplishing by, like, these mass turnouts and protests and stuff. We were curious about what some of the bigger ones in the past were, and we were Googling around a little bit for it. And we're looking at some major protests in history, and something that's really apparent in all of these, like, I mean, one article listed, like, the storming of the Bastille in 1789 as a significant protest. And in looking at, you know, a dozen or so mass protests, like, historically, it's crazy to see how media evolves and... Again, this idea of disseminating information or making people aware of these things really quickly and to have a very clear picture of what was going on, it's like the older the event goes, the more primitive the media surrounding it is, you know? So, like, the storming of the Bastille imagery is all paintings of what happened back then because there weren't cameras to record it and publish it to a Snapchat story. And as time goes on, you can kind of see, like, the media evolve and get better and better up through, like, grainy black and white photos, in the early 1900s, up through, like, color photos, in the 60s and 70s. And then finally today we have, you can literally broadcast an event live directly to people all around the world through Instagram or through Snapchat. Or whatever platform. And the interesting thing is that I think that every individual has a voice on the internet for sure, but because there are so many voices, it's very difficult to stand out. But I think the connection of technology, the connective property of technology makes it such that when the whole hive mind largely agrees on something, like, we want gun control reform in the United States, it seems to be that most people are for that at this point, you can very quickly mobilize and react. You know, it's almost like the internet and social media are kind of this like a central nervous system for human beings, where if you can imagine that, like, your leg was not connected to your arm or, like, to your brain. And, like, somebody could kick your leg and you wouldn't feel or register it, or because that signal traveled so slowly to your brain because it was going by the way of newspaper, or you know, it's just much faster, I think, to get the message out and to get people to mobilize and react to things. So it's very interesting.
So basically you're saying if it's a topic, especially if it's a topic that everyone is interested in and wants or can get behind, then it just multiplies how much faster that process happens throughout.
Exactly. And I think that's
with the technology we have.
Yeah. And I think that's why you start to see where, you know, where social media, I mean, you remember like the Arab Spring and all of these social media related political movements that occurred in places where folks were oppressed by governments or leaders, and largely a group of people don't want to feel oppressed or ruled over or whatever. And so that connective tissue of social media enabled them all to like realize that nobody really wants this, and we can all kind of join together and mobilize and communicate and make change. And so that's why you see revolutions happening all over the world. That's why you see people out marching for this group of kids today that never did before, even though we've kind of had these tools for a while now. Your agency in this world is going to be pretty tightly bound to your ability to use and manipulate social media. So it's something to invest time and energy into versus like throwing your hands up and being like, I don't get Snapchat, so I'm just going to delete it and not be a part of it or whatever. Because this stuff is increasingly going to have an impact on how everything works. And if you don't have a working knowledge of what's going on and how these things spread ideas or connect people, you're going to get kind of lost or left behind as the world moves faster and faster.
So on our last episode, we talked about Uber and their autonomous vehicle having the first pedestrian casualty.
In the investigation that followed, it turns out that they're not as much at fault as originally reported. This woman kind of abruptly stepped in front of a car, and a lot of people who looked at the footage felt like even a human being would have had a difficult time reacting to what happened there. So I think that it leans more toward this person being at fault than necessarily the autonomous vehicle. But
we also talked about that there was a vast increase in the amount of pedestrian deaths since 2010.
Right.
And sort of speculated about what that could be.
And I'm pretty sure that at least I didn't have any good idea. There was like befuddling.
It was something we were certainly pondering. Until someone pointed out the obvious.
Which is?
Well, apparently smartphone use has increased from 78 million to 262 million since in between 2010 and 2016.
Yeah. Smartphones.
And they, as much as we love these things, they say before this article came out, they say that smartphones, if you're texting and driving, that's the equivalent of being drunk and driving.
I think it's got to be worse.
So that means we have millions and millions and millions of drunk drivers on the road.
Yeah, and it's also people...
Essentially.
It's also people walking around on crosswalks or crossing streets and not paying attention because they're looking at their phones. Because
they're also looking at their phones.
Yeah, I see signs. When I read that in the article, when they said like the smartphones are probably the issue, it made me immediately think of seeing bus ads and signs even around Los Angeles of like, pay attention to the road, like look both, like reminding people to that they're out walking around because the advertisements were specifically worded about like not staring at your phone as you're crossing the street and stuff. And the fact that those exist,
like they have to let us know.
Whenever there's a sign somewhere, it's because somebody's trying to stop something that's happening. Right. And so it's like, people must just be getting hit left and right crossing intersections or whatever, because they're staring at their phones all the time.
Well, one thing they pointed out was that the responsibility is not just on the drivers, but also on the communities that create the features that improved pedestrian deaths back when they were at their lowest point, which is reduced speeds, more signals, yeah. safer crosswalks, etc. So the question I have for you is, how do you think that they could improve city infrastructure to help the pedestrians be safer? Short of these obvious signs that say, look up.
There's a couple of things that I think you can do, right? One is that the fastest that we can roll out, the faster that we can roll out autonomous driving technology, the better. Like, this is going to be the thing that saves us from, ultimately, I mean, there may be a few casualties in the way, but you can't make an omelet without cracking some eggs. And like, autonomous driving vehicles is the solution to almost all of these problems. Like, drivers texting on phones, like, the answer is not to build like annoying phone prompts that are like, are you driving right now? Do you want us to disable the phone because you're driving? That stuff's never going to solve the problem. Just taking the human driver out of the equation is going to solve the problem. So the faster that cities can enable autonomous vehicles to participate and be a part of what's going on, that'll be the thing that drives, I think, pedestrian deaths down or pedestrian incidents down more than anything else. Secondarily, like, improving public transit, you know, making public transit something that's really desirable to use and that gives you coverage of your whole city. Like, I love going to cities that you can get from anywhere in the city to another point in the city by hopping on a train or a series of trains, and where it's clean and it's reliable. That's a pretty great thing to have. Los Angeles doesn't have really good public transit systems. I can kind of get on Elon's wavelength about, you never know who you're going to ride with. Like, having been on the train in LA a few times and seen some frightening things. But those are the big ones. Autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, it'd be a step in the direction.
Yeah, and then I think also, like, giving people... So in Santa Monica, we have Bird scooters, which have been heavily featured on our program and that we're very proud of as a local startup. But there is also... So from Santa Monica to Venice, all the way down, I think, to, like, Marina del Rey, there's a bike path that you can cruise down on a bike, on an electric scooter, on some other kind of personal mobility vehicle. And cruising down that thing on like a Bird or whatever, or probably a bicycle, is super fun and it's awesome. And so to continue to invest in technology that helps to move people around in ways that aren't intersecting with cars or roads, if they have to be on cars and roads, yeah, giving them wider lanes or making it more accessible for those sort of vehicles and people to kind of walk or do whatever, I think would be a great thing. So, like, Santa Monica, for instance, had started to penalize Bird for making those scooters available. It seems they're working it out, at least there's not a shortage of Bird scooters around the West Side. They haven't stopped being used, it seems. But you would want cities and regulators to embrace this stuff and to make it, instead of outlawing it or fighting it, embrace it and find a way to give people that option. Because the more that people are using pedestrian, like, bike paths or, like, vehicle paths, and the more that your city is configured and gives people the affordance of doing that stuff, I think the better it will be.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective, especially the idea of having some kind of thoroughfare that's dedicated to pedestrians and or bicycles.
I mean, you know,
and birds.
Yeah, and frankly, the city
that doesn't intersect with traffic short of lights. Like, you know how in Santa Monica they have that one where you have to stop your bike and literally there's, I don't know how many cities I've seen this in, but literally there's a bike symbol and it turns red, meaning you cannot go bike. Yeah. Like, implement more infrastructure like that.
This might even be a little controversial, but if cities are unwilling to invest in the physical infrastructure to expand their public transit, they should subsidize ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft and companies like that to bring the cost of transportation down for everybody. you know, that would be kind of an interesting angle too, right? So instead of spending, because like there are all these crazy infrastructure projects, like there's some tunnel somewhere, maybe it's Chicago or maybe it's Seattle. There's some tunnel project somewhere that it's like they've spec'd it all out and it's like, okay, what we have achieved here is creating the most costly per square foot project in the history of like infrastructure. Like it's like absurdly expensive, like billions and billions of dollars, like to build a tunnel that is largely ineffective in solving the problems that the city has. But the idea is just that, like, instead of spending all of that money on a huge piece of infrastructure that's going to take years and years and years and not be effective, like, just dump it into making Uber free on on the weekends, or taking a few bucks off that thing so it only costs you 50 cents or a dollar to get almost anywhere in the city. That would be baller.
That's such an interesting perspective. Yeah, it's the the one in Seattle anyway, there's a lot of tunnel projects going on, but the one in Seattle that's way behind schedule, they were saying that it faces a potential $400 million in cost overruns.
Yeah. And
I wonder how many Uber rides that would be for Seattle.
That's like Uber for the year for the whole city for free. You know, or something. But I think like that's,
oh my gosh. I'm going to add one more little tidbit. I just read the project was approved by the Washington legislature, not by voters. Yeah. And the overall cost is $3.2 billion.
That's what I'm saying. And I think that there's a lot of controversy surrounding like the efficacy of this project, period. It's like you're building a tunnel, like the elements of this are so absurd. And the other part of this too, and that's something that many people probably don't realize, is that ride sharing services like Uber and Lyft are each ride is heavily subsidized by the enormous cash reserves these companies have through raising gazillions of venture capital dollars. So in other words, whatever the current price of your Uber or Lyft is, it's artificially low because they're knocking a few dollars. They're trying to make the rides as cheap as possible to create loyal customers and a large customer base. And so the ride might even cost as much as $10 or $15. Like the $5 ride that you're paying today may in reality cost closer to like $10 or $15 once you pay the driver and you pay the gas and all the other costs associated with making that ride possible. And so eventually that's going to correct, right? Eventually they're going to have to say, we can't afford to continue subsidizing these rides. And so the prices are going to shoot way up eventually, I think. I mean, I don't see how they couldn't. Like when you look at the financials that occasionally leak from these ride-sharing companies, the unit economics are not like stable or sustainable. So who's going to pay the bill then, right? Anyway, so maybe it's cities do that. Cause if your taxes are going to go somewhere, like, wouldn't you rather, you know, like if your taxes are going to go somewhere, would you rather them go to a $4 billion useless tunnel or like to getting cheaper Uber rides or something? I mean, to me, it's like subsidizing transit would be a great, or ride sharing would be a great use of those resources. Better one at least. Cut.